More than 22,000 refugees were resettled after the Vietnam War through Fort Indian Town Gap Military Base. That was over four decades ago. Keystone Crossroads' Emily Pravity spent some time at the Gap recently with a Vietnamese refugee-turned-advocate who says resettlement has become harder since her arrival in 1975.
Even after 40 years, Ho Thanh Nguyen seemed familiar with a lot of what we saw driving through the Gap.
That's an old building right there.
Ho Thanh stayed in Area 6, where newer buildings used for National Guard training have replaced her barracks.
That's the C-130, right? Yep, I remember that.
Ho Thanh told me later that her first time flying was on a C-130.
From Philippines to Guam Island. We sit on the floor on the C-130, and with the seatbelt across from us, you're like the cargo. We just hold on the seatbelt. That's it.
Ho Thanh and her five siblings fled South Vietnam during the final days of the war, reaching the Philippines by boat. The journey took over a week. As the oldest child, Ho Thanh was in charge because their parents had stayed behind with their grandparents. She was 20 years old.
Everybody have a handful of rice and a glass of water. When the storm came, we took plastic bag to hold the water, and that's what we used, you know, to drink it when we need water. My brother, my little brother was starving. All my brother and sister were starving, but especially the little one.
This left Ho Thanh with post-traumatic stress disorder.
If you go to my car, you will see water, cracker, cookies, and the blankie. And I have a sleeping bag too, because I don't know where I will be the next, where my next meal is. Even I know that I have freedom here, I have everything that I have it here, and so uncertain.
It seems like challenges never cease for Ho Thanh and tens of millions of other refugees. Finding work, learning a new language, trying to get a better job, facing discrimination. Ho Thanh thinks it's harder now for refugees. She's been working with the vulnerable population through the nonprofit she founded 17 years ago, the Pennsylvania Immigrant and Refugee Women's Network, or PAIRWIN.
I saw the needs there for the newcomer. That's why I create the Pennsylvania Immigrant and Refugee Women Network.
Ho Thanh says there's at least one way that resettlement's easier now.
With the technology of the news and media and the internet, the information, they know more information than I know ahead of time. The 1975, we don't have that.
There were fewer resettlement agencies then and virtually no infrastructure compared to what's in place today. To understand more, we turn to Alan Kraut, an American University history professor focused on immigration and ethnic history and the history of American medicine and public health. Kraut says regret over how the United States handled refugee resettlement after World War II seemed to drive policy in the late 70s.
There were 11 million displaced persons. The United States ended up taking in a total of only about 400,000. We were not very generous in that period. We were a bit more generous following the Vietnam War.
Ho Thanh and other refugees were evacuated from South Asia as quickly as possible and brought to the U.S., then went through processing and ultimately found their first jobs and homes all in a matter of months. Now screening takes years and happens while refugees live in camps or other temporary accommodations closer to their countries of origin.
In 1980, the United States passed a law called the Refugee Act, which adopted the language of the United Nations, and that is we define as a refugee someone who has a well-founded fear of persecution. So that's led to a great deal of screening, and in the period, particularly since 9/11, screening with concern for national security issues.
The law also established an annual ceiling, a term you might recognize from recent debates over federal policy. The first ceiling limited refugee admissions to 50,000 people. It took effect in 1981. The year prior, the U.S. had admitted about 200,000 refugees.
There are always exceptions in the face of particular crises. But remember that all during this period, the United States is admitting legally over a million people a year. In addition to that, there's increasing concern about the number of undocumented migrants coming to the United States. So all of this is in the mix in these discussions.
Kraut says other issues brought up by policymakers included effects on local agencies and resources and how to prevent overloading them. In the 70s, refugees also were processed through just 4 military bases, including Fort Indiantown Gap, and just a few outside resettlement agencies were involved. Now, 9 national organizations resettle refugees through a network of local offices in countless cities across the country, in partnership with the Departments of State and Homeland Security. In Ho Tang's view, this particular change is critical.
The pockets of refugee come in because so small, they have a hard time to connecting with other.
Then there's federal funding. Right now, resettlement agencies are worried about cuts because the admission ceiling was lowered after President Trump took office, midway through the federal fiscal year, so most agencies ended up getting less cash than planned, according to Charlotte Fry, who heads the State Office of Refugee Resettlement.
With fewer arrivals and fewer dollars in place for the reception and placement program, the money that is received, it needs to be targeted toward employment services, as well as, you know, ensuring that refugees have access to English language classes. Beyond that, money that used to flow much more openly for case management, that can't be a focus because you just simply can't support it.
Some resettlement agencies are turning to churches and other partners for volunteers to train for things like enrolling children in school. And it seems more refugees will probably utilize nonprofits like Parowan for referrals to transportation, mental health and other services, educational seminars, extra ESL instruction, and group therapy of sorts.
It's the taboo that you go and see psychiatrists or psychologists. It's a story circle.
Parowan's been training other providers on how to run story circles recently, but has been hosting its own events every couple months for years. It's a forum free of the stigma that many of these women might fear for seeking formal treatment, and it's in their own language. Back at the base, Ho Tang explained in more detail.
Even I go to the psychologist, they cannot help me because I couldn't speak English. And if you cannot speak the language, your own language, to express yourself, it doesn't do any good. That's why we have a story circle and the people come and they can talk about anything that they want to.
Emily Previty, Keystone Crossroads.